Locally owned and operated. Really, Cambridge 105.
Hey, it's all going to work out. Here's Sports.
Yeah, good afternoon and welcome to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Mike's here.
Hello.
And Brian's here.
Good afternoon.
And I'm Chris. We'll be talking Wimbledon and the Tour de France this hour, as well as all the usual fun and games. But first of all, it's time for the sports news. Nico Rosberg won a dramatic British Grand Prix at Silverstone this afternoon. In a race overshadowed by a number of tyre failures, Rosberg held on to take the win from Red Bull's Mark Webber, with Ferrari's Fernando Alonso moving up from 9th place to finish 3rd. Rosberg's Mercedes teammate and crowd favourite Lewis Hamilton dropped out of the lead into last place after his tyre problems, but managed to work his way back up to 4th spot to retain the same position in the Drivers' Championship. Reigning champion Sebastian Vettel still leads overall, but Alonso's podium finish closed the gap on the German to just 21 points. Rosberg was since called to appear before race stewards for an infringement, but escaped with a severe reprimand for driving too fast when the yellow flags were out, so his race victory stands. Belgium's Yann Baculens won the second stage of the Tour de France in Corsica this afternoon to take the leader's yellow jersey. Baculens was part of a six-man breakaway and attacked within the last kilometre to hold off the closing pack led by favourite Peter Sagan by a single second. Yesterday's winner Marcel Kittel was distanced on the early climbs and came in over 10 minutes down, but overall favourite Chris Froome finished safely in the main bunch alongside his rivals. Wimbledon resumes tomorrow with Andy Murray facing the 20th seed from Russia, Mikhail Yuzhny, for a place in the quarterfinals. Murray will be second on centre court tomorrow following Serena Williams and preceding his main rival Novak Djokovic, who takes on Germany's Tommy Haas. Laura Robson takes on Estonia's Kaia Kanepi on court one, with the reward for another victory likely to be a quarterfinal match with Serena Williams. Britain's defending men's doubles champion Johnny Marais and new partner Colin Fleming are on court 7 tomorrow, also looking to make the quarterfinals. The Confederations Cup will finish tonight with hosts Brazil taking on world champion Spain in the final at Estadio Maracanã. In the first meeting between the two sides for 14 years, Brazil are likely to be unchanged, while Cesc Fabregas and Roberto Soldado may return after missing the semi-final against Italy for Spain. The Italians are currently playing against Uruguay in the third place playoff in Salvador and have a 1-0 lead at half time. In athletics, there was some British success today at the Diamond League meeting in Birmingham. Perry Shakes-Drayton won the women's 400-metre hurdles, Christina Hurigu won the 400 metres flat, and 18-year-old Jessica Judd had a superb victory in the 800 metres. Meanwhile, Olympic champion Greg Rutherford finished second in the long jump, Rhys Williams came second in the 400-metre hurdles, and Huntingdon's Robbie Grabars came third in the high jump. Promising sprinter James Dassaiolu ran a personal best 10.03 seconds to finish second in the men's 100 metres, and Mo Farah won a very competitive men's 5,000 metre race. England's Luke Wright scored 81 from 49 balls as Sussex won their Friends Life T20 match against Middlesex, and England's Test team are playing an Ashes warm-up game against Essex at Chelmsford, with 23-year-old leg spinner Tom Craddock taking 3 wickets before tea, including that of Kevin Peterson for 49. England have recovered to 322 for 7, with Tim Bresnan and Graham Swan unbeaten half-centuries. And Ryder Cup player Paul Casey won his first tournament for 2 years today, taking the Irish Open by 3 strokes after holding a remarkable 70-foot eagle putt at the last hole. And that is all the latest sports news.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
And it's Chris Duerden, Mike Kerwin and Brian Harris with you through till 7 o'clock this evening, at which time Alan Alder will be here with Rock Lit. So do stay tuned throughout the rest of the evening here on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105, from the top of Guider Street. Now, we'll be previewing the Tour de France in about 20 minutes' time, but first of all, what a week it's been at Wimbledon.
What a week. It's been a great week, fantastic week. Lots of interesting things have happened. It's probably been the craziest ever opening week of Wimbledon I can remember, and I can remember a lot, Chris. Yeah, all kinds of things have been happening. Seeds tumbling left, right and centre. People slipping over. Brits doing well. It's been people retiring hurt. It's been chaos, madness. Bit of rain, of course.
More seeds tumbling than a farmer's cupboard collapsing when he stores all his seeds on the top shelf.
Combine harvester going haywire.
That doesn't really
that would have been slightly better, Brian. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you remember last week when you and I previewed Wimbledon and we made a number of predictions and we were saying, well, first of all, we were talking about the controversy going into Wimbledon that Nadal had only been seeded 5th and that meant that Federer and Nadal were going to play out this quarterfinal.
Yes.
And that was a shame because, you know, Nadal and Federer have had some great battles over the years, and they're only going to meet in the quarterfinals. Well,
What happened there?
Well, on day one, Nadal, probably the big story, which we forget now because it seems like a long time ago, lots happened since, but Nadal was knocked out by this guy, Steve Darcis, or Darcy. There seemed to be consensus about...
Although I think I heard that they had checked with the ATP and been told it was Darcy.
Darcy. That, yes. So my joke works. I say Darcy bustles out.
Oh, good.
Rafa Nadal, you see, but... Yeah. But they kept calling him Darcis. I was like, oh, you're ruining my joke. But anyway, yeah, this guy, Steve Darcis, was famous for about, 24 hours, really. That was the first time Nadal has lost in the first round of any of the 35 Grand Slam tournaments he's entered.
Why was that? Is there an obvious reason? I mean, I know he's been injured, but
He has been injured.
He has won his comeback tournament, hasn't he?
Yeah, yes. he won the French Open. And you can't win that if you're not, you know, fairly fit. But having said that, he was certainly kind of... struggling a little bit with his leg.
He was. In the press conference, though, I know the very first thing he said, and this was clever, very clever from Nadal, he said, I'm not going to talk about my knees. Which, if you think about it, the very first thing he said was about his knees, but he basically was making the point that he didn't want to make an excuse and that he felt fine. He wasn't actually himself saying that he was injured.
Maybe
you see what he's done there.
Maybe he just doesn't want to talk about any of his extended family.
It's like Harry Redknapp saying, oh, I don't want to talk about that particular player. Like in a press conference, that surreptitiously indicating that he may well be interested in
it. Exactly. Yeah. So the only other thing that really happened on day one, I guess probably more expected than Nadal crashing out, was all of the Brits. Well, many of the Brits who were given wildcards lost their games. James Wood played well against Liu, but went down in four sets. Kyle Edmund, we were talking about him. We're giving him the big build-up. He's a very young player. It's his first senior tournament. He lost to this guy, Jerzy Janowicz, who's actually still in the draw. He's done remarkably well this
year. Yeah, good week for the Poles, certainly. One of their doubles pairings has caused a bit of an upset as well yesterday. So
yeah.
The Poles are going well.
Yeah, and Radwanska's one of the few female
seeds
who's still actually left in the ladies. But yeah, Baltacic, Jotovong and Joanna Konta all lost in straight sets. So yeah, the big story day one was Nadal, and then day two, again, Laura Robson, she won her game against Kirilenko, the 10th seed, in straight sets, and was looking pretty strong. She hits the ball remarkably hard.
She's going to win, right? She's going to win Wimbledon. That's what we're now saying.
So
definitely,
yeah, you do know that she's due to play Serena Williams in, if she gets through. If she beats Kanepi, she'll play Williams in the quarterfinal. So,
are we doing this chronologically?
More or less.
Yeah. Okay.
More
so we'll talk about Robson's third round victory a bit later on. So that was a brilliant game. But,
yeah. So speaking of Kanepi, by the way, I watched the game with Tara Moore. She was the last remaining Brit, I think, apart from Robson and Murray. Tara Moore, she put up a good fight, but Kaya Kanepi didn't look to me that strong a player at that point, and she's obviously gone on to win her next two games. So she's growing in confidence, the Estonian, quite a young Estonian player. So, day three was the big news day in Wimbledon. Wacky Wednesday, Wounded Wednesday, I don't know what you want to call it.
Well, before we go on to Wounded Wednesday, just to remind... you that after our Tour de France preview at about 7:15 we'll be taking a dip into the archive and reminiscing over a classic sporting event.
Oh yes.
And we thought we'd give you a couple of clues towards that, and I completely forgot to give you the first clue. So it's Brian this week, and so he hasn't told us what it is.
Yeah.
So
okay.
The first clue for what we're going to be talking about at 7:15.
My first clue is the cost of a standard rail ticket from Madrid to Lisbon on board the overnight train Lusitania. That's the clue.
Are you sure that's the clue?
I'm sure that's the clue. Or it will all be explained later.
Say it once more and then we'll move on.
The cost of a standard rail ticket from Madrid to Lisbon on board the overnight train called the Lusitania.
Okay. Wacky Wednesday then.
Moving on, the clues get easier. Yeah, so on Wednesday, this was day three of Wimbledon. Obviously, Nadal had been the big story up to this point. This was the day that, first of all, Federer lost to this guy, Sergei Stakhovsky. That was probably he's ranked 116th in the world, Ukrainian, Sergei Stakhovsky, and that's Federer's earliest exit from Wimbledon in 11 years and his earliest exit from any Grand Slam in 10 years. So Federer's got this remarkable record, I think, of 36 quarter-final appearances in Grand Slams. And so this was a huge upset. It's amazing, really. 36 consecutive appearances in quarterfinals.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was on Wednesday. Why are you grinning?
I'm grinning because I think I might have worked out the clue.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah.
You're still thinking about the clue. It's like me last week.
I think it's the currency, isn't it? That's the Okay. I might be onto something here.
Good.
Anyway, continue.
Good. Yeah. So Federer was the big story on Wednesday, but on that same day, Sharapova, obviously the number two seed in the ladies, also went out. And she
as expected.
Yeah, as you predicted. As you predicted quite rightly last Sunday. And she lost to the world, the 131st ranked player in the world, Michelle Larcher de Brito. And I guess one point from that is neither of those players actually is still in the draw. So they have their moment in the sun. They tend to, there's an upset. But it's quite rare that those players then go on to actually sort of do anything really beyond that. Steve Darcy had to retire injured. Everyone was going, oh, come on. You've beaten Nadal and now you're withdrawing.
It's usually quite difficult because they had to do a whole bunch of media stuff after the game and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of distracts it.
Yeah,
distracts them. You know,
they're not used to it
from their actual day job.
I have a theory that Darcy was actually maybe Pete Sampras in disguise or something, and Murray had put him in as a ringer, just nip in, get rid of Nadal, and then you can go off home, pretend you're injured or something.
Maybe you should look for evidence of a lot of razor blades being being bought in London.
So also withdrawing on Wacky Wednesday or Wounded Wednesday, Cilic, John Isner, Stepanek, Tsonga retired hurt, and Shvedova as well. So due to both injuries and upsets, there weren't many. I think at this point there were four of the top 10 ladies' seeds left in the draw and five of the men. So it'd been a sort of carnage, really.
Well, and the key thing was that obviously the top 8 seeds in the men's, there's 4 in each half, and the 3 that had gone out were the other 3 in Murray's half, so all of a sudden there were no top 8 seeds in Murray's half of the draw apart from him. And it obviously has really opened up for him, which a lot of people would say is obviously great news, but it still means
that's right.
At the end of the day, as things stand, he would still have to beat Djokovic in the final. There's no different to what it would have been before, so
respect,
a long way to go.
Don't get
too carried away just yet, people.
Yeah, you're right, but with Nadal, Federer and Tsonga all out of the draw, Murray's the only seed left in the entire bottom half of the draw, and in theory, you know, as Chris has just said, his path to the final should be straightforward, but then he's got to play the joker. Also out was Ivanovic. She was beaten as well by Eugenie Bouchard, who
Bouchard.
I was keeping an eye on. She's this rather charming young Canadian player, best friends with Laura Robson. They've done this Gangnam Style video. Have you seen that?
I've seen the Gangnam Style video.
I'm sure you have.
It's rather amusing.
I think it's doing the rounds. Yeah,
they showed it on BBC Two yesterday, I think.
Yeah, also out, Caroline Wozniacki, who, of course, better known as our Max other half, Rory McIlroy's girlfriend. She was beaten 6-2, 6-2. So, and then Dustin Brown, he was my favourite player from Wednesday. He beat Leighton Hewitt. Obviously, he's described as a flamboyant German-Jamaican, and that's not a phrase you hear very often. he's got his Twitter name on his shirt as well. I think it's Dread something, Dread Strings or Dread... like Dredd, because he's got dreadlocks, you see. And he doesn't have a coach as well at the moment. And he just looks like some super cool sort of reggae DJ Jamaican. And he's in whites on a tennis court. You're going, who let this guy in? Security, you know.
So
anyway, Dustin Brown.
We actually think that he qualified and didn't just talk his way into the...
he looked like he had just blagged his way on court. But he was, he's a very charismatic guy. And unfortunately, he then lost in the next round. And then, Azarenka also withdrew. So the second seed, Victoria Azarenka, had to withdraw as well. So, not many players left in by this point in the top 10 seeds.
So what about Tennessee Thursday then?
So the best, I guess, not much happened compared to the day before. Mathieu withdrew. Lodra, also a French player, had to withdraw as well. And this was when the story about what's going on with the Wimbledon courts this year. Because a lot of the players... Sharapova was very... annoyed, upset. She was grumbling to the umpire about the court. She said, I've never slipped 3 times. This is my Sharapova impression. I've never fallen over 3 times on court before.
It's like she's in the room.
Very good. A couple of them in there, Brian.
Yeah, so and the Wimbledon club came out with an official statement saying, we've not done anything different this year. And I think it's this weird sort of crowd psychology that as soon as a couple of players started falling over injured, I think the rest of the players sort of, it kind of infected them.
Have
you got proof for this?
No, that's just my theory.
Everyone's always slipped over at Wimbledon. It's not a new thing.
Yeah.
No, it's grass.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the Djokovic was easing through his matches fairly comfortably. So was Murray, of course. I don't think either of them has dropped a set so far. So in terms of like the top two seeds, they were going through quite well. Serena Williams as well was powering through. And then day five was Laura Robson was in action. She beat the Colombian player Duque Marino 6-4, 6-1.
Yeah, and at that point you're thinking that Robson does look very good. That match is obviously delayed by a day because of the rain on some of the outside courts. So Robson had to play a third round match the day after that yesterday. After a second round game, she looked very comfortable. And I think the best thing about it was that she seemed comfortable with the status of favourite in that match. She just dominated it, and it was a very un-women's British tennis player like performance.
Yeah,
she also came out and was interviewed after the game, and she was saying all the right things. Right, she was saying that she didn't start very well, but she tried to focus on point to point and kind of block out some of the crowd, kind of take the positives from the crowd, but not let it overwhelm her.
A lot of pressure. And also as the tournament progresses, there'll be even more pressure on her because she's now, I think, she's got through to the further in the tournament than anyone since, is it Sam Smith in 1998? So it's been a long time since any like British lady has got that far. Obviously, we've had Henman before Murray, but in the women's draw, she's definitely now the focus of all British attention.
Yeah.
And we build them up, we knock them down.
So to round off on Laura Robson then, I'm skipping ahead to yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
If that makes sense. So she was playing the New Zealander. And
Irakovic,
and she's
incredible game.
Irakovic started really well, serving
6-1.
Superbly, mm-hmm. and a really booming kind of into out forehand across court. She, like you say, won the first set really comfortably. I watched the majority of this game, and in the second set, Laura Robson was
5-3
down. 5-3
down.
Mm-hmm. And then I think won the next seven or eight games in a row. So won the set 7-5, and then surged 3 or 4 love up in the deciding set. Irakovic came back at her a little bit, but Robson held on to take the win. But so that kind of from Irakovic serving for the match at 5-4, Robson really kind of showed her mettle. And, mm-hmm. and to be honest, as soon as Robson won that game for 5-all, you kind of felt like Irakovic. Like that was her chance gone. She really looked like she knew that was her chance gone, and it was just a matter of time for Robson just to turn the screw.
It was a very curious match. I mean, you're right. The first set flew by in 22 minutes, and Robson just didn't. She didn't get into it at all. She'd lost at 6-1 before. She'd barely drawn breath, and as you said, 5-3 down. And the commentators were basically sounding the death knell, assuming that even if she did have a mini comeback, it was too little too late. And then she won 8 games on the trot, and she very nearly won the ninth. She had a break point in the ninth as well, I think, in the final set. Amazing remarkable turnaround. And really it was a combination of Robson sticking in there, being quite resilient, but also Irakovic, when she saw the finish line, she started serving double faults, and you could tell she just didn't believe she could win that game. And she only had a game to win. I know people will focus on Robson, but from Irakovic's point of view, come on, you only needed one more game, and she couldn't quite do it, and you could tell the confidence was draining out of
her. That's right.
And they're friends as well. They play together quite a lot. They know each other really well.
Of course, because Robson's originally from Australia as well, isn't she?
Yes.
Although she moved over.
No, she moved when she was
very young.
Yeah, she's only 6.
She didn't meet Irakovic before then. And New Zealand is quite a long way away from Australia. Okay, I don't know why I said that. That was a bit stupid, wasn't it?
I think they just happened to practice together.
But like you say, Irakovic, I think she served double fault to lose the game when she was serving for the match, and then she served double fault when she was serving to stay in the second set well. And
I wonder if the crowd got to her, because obviously highly partisan crowd, very noisy, lots of shouts of come on Laura, and the crowd was pretty dead in the first set. And at 6-1 to Irakovic, Laura Robson just wasn't playing well at all, and there was silence. And then as soon as they sensed she was getting a bit of a foothold, the noise level just increased, and Irakovic sort of faded, Robson just got stronger.
Were the people going crazy on Robson's green?
Is that the new
Murray Mound? Oh,
that's poor.
On the Henman Hill.
That is poor. Yeah. So anyway, I guess just to round up on the rest of the ladies' draw, another seed went on Friday. What was Angelique Kerber, and actually she lost to Kanepi, who faces Robson tomorrow, and that should be a good game tomorrow. I think there'll be a lot of focus on Laura Robson, obviously, but do wonder how that might affect her. I'm not confident, Chris, to be honest. I know you were saying she's going to get through. Actually, no, she's already got through to what you predicted, hasn't she? She's already made
the last 16, which is what I predicted. The draw looked like... Well, what we were talking about last week is that if she could beat Kirilenko, the draw would open up for her to get through to the last 16, and then it looked like she would play Angelique Kerber in the last 16. Kerber's obviously out, so she has a chance now to get through to the quarterfinals, but, like you say, Kaya Kanepi playing pretty well, and I don't know. I would still tip Robson to win, and then I'd be amazed if she managed to get past Serena. But yeah, I'd tip Robson to win tomorrow.
Yeah, Serena yesterday playing Kimiko Date Crum, 5'4", the super Japanese granny. She's not actually a granny, but someone somewhere called her a Japanese grandmother. I think it was on the sort of news program this morning. I thought it was a bit harsh. And that was just brutal, absolutely brutal. It was like a giant puma sort of batting away a small kitten, because of, you know, Serena Williams is obviously, you know what, 6 foot, incredibly strong. And the difference in power between the two women hitting the ball. So Serena Williams would like blast this ball at her, and then it would be like me playing, you know. It was like, but the commentary was a bit patronising, you know, about the age difference and the fact, oh, this is what tennis was like back in the 80s or whatever. And it was like comparing the clash of styles. But she won 6-2, 6-love. So she didn't do the double donut. That was the talk. Could she do the double donut?
What's the double donut?
Well, 6-love is called a donut in tennis.
Oh, okay.
Because of the hole, the round thing. I don't know. It's tennis players, isn't it? But a double donut is obviously winning 6-love, 6-love.
Okay.
So she got two games out of Serena. And again, the crowd were cheering her on, hoping for a bit more tennis probably, but also the sight of this sort of aging Japanese small pocket rocket charging around. So there you go.
So your views on the tournament overall so far? There's not been much kind of rain interruption, and obviously with the roof on centre court now, that helps, so there's always play of some sort. And like you say, lots of upsets and some exciting games.
Yeah, I mean, it's been for me, it's been one of the best Wimbledons I can remember, because of all the upsets and because of the some of the, you know, younger players maybe making a bit of an impact. So who was the Janovic is still in there, I think, and I'm tipping him to go a bit further. I think he's a very good player. He beat Almagro, Stepanek. He might do okay. And in that half of the draw, there's not big names left. You know,
is Jankovic not due to play Murray in the quarters?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
If they both win their games tomorrow, so. So tomorrow will be last 16 for everyone, and then the women's quarterfinals.
Oh, sorry, in the semis, I think they would meet.
Oh, really?
Possibly,
in the semis.
Yeah.
Women's quarterfinals on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Men's quarterfinals on Wednesday, and then men and women alternate through to the finals next weekend. We'll obviously be on air same time next week. And last year we actually got to commentate on the death knell of Andy Murray's tournament.
Yeah.
I'm sure everyone still remembers that.
I'm sure you'll be...
Chris's famous line was it? Oh, no, he's lost.
Oh, is it in? Is it? Oh, no, he's lost.
He's
it's up there with I Think It's All Over for me in a kind of legendary commentary. But yeah, if the men's final is still going on at 6 o'clock next Sunday, then I would tune in for commentary.
Live commentary. One of the facts I really should point out, which I think everyone here will be pleased by, is that no American has made it through to the third round in Wimbledon for the first time in 101 years.
Yeah.
Jimmy Connors was particularly scathing about the current crop of Americans. Mm. I think the last one was Bobby Reynolds, who made it through to lose against Djokovic. Mm, and after that, no Americans. It's quite unusual in the men's. Obviously, the women have got Williams and Sloane Stephens. She's the rising star of American female tennis. But
okay. So to go around the table, tip for the men's singles and tip for the women's singles, please.
Serena Williams for me, and Andy Murray, I think.
I'm going to say the same. I can't see past Serena Williams, and I think Murray may do it this year.
Okay, well, again, it's impossible to see past Serena Williams, but I'll go Djokovic just to be different, and we'll see how we get on.
What have you got against Brit Andy Murray?
No, he's Scottish until he wins it, Brian. Remember that.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
So that's Wimbledon done. Brian, you got another clue for us for the archive feature.
Second clue is, for the first time, this tournament went from 8 to 16 teams.
Okay,
previously
it was 16 teams.
It was 8 teams, and this was a 16-team tournament for the first time in this tournament's history.
Okay. Right, before we go on to our Tour de France preview, it's time for... my favourite part of the show. It's Chris's Cambridge 105, Stat 105. Community radio in your city. Cambridge 105. So, my 105 stat for this week. 105 is the number of international caps held by Sami Hyypiä, Fernando Torres and Martin Stocklasser of Liechtenstein.
Wow.
Well, I knew Stocklasser. I didn't know the other two.
Torres will obviously add to that later tonight in the Confederations Cup final. But for now, he's on 105 caps. So there. Community radio in your city.
Cambridge 105. Every second Sunday of the month, tune in to Cambridge 105 for Our Mill Road at 9 p.m. with me, Kerri-Anne Littlechild. I'll be covering the latest news and events from Cambridge's most cosmopolitan street here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
And I tell you what, we forgot to do our little music thing again, didn't we?
Play the Wimbledon music.
Okay, this is the Wimbledon music, which I was supposed to play about 20 minutes ago. It's my green, green grass of home. It's my green, green grass. I could have saved it for next week, really, couldn't I? It's my green, green grass of home. It's the only way we can be free. Murray the Hump, that is. Yeah, all remember them, don't we? Okay, so it's Tour de France time now. You'll recognise this ditty. You won't at all. It's a French singer called Coralie Clément. Yeah, fortunately, those lyrics translate as I'm on a bike riding around Corsica and I'm really knackered. So it's a suitable...
Very suitable, yeah.
Suitable pick there.
Written entirely for the first stage of the...
No, it's just total coincidence of that 10 years old, that song. Yeah, there you go.
We'll take your word for it.
We'll spend the next 15 minutes or so talking about the Tour de France. It's a preview of the Tour. Obviously, 2 days have already taken place. We're 2 days in, so it's a preview of the next 19 days the Tour de France, plus a little quick review.
You're slightly redefining the word preview a little bit.
What's happened so far? I thought Mike was going to ask me a question then.
Well, you gave him the nod.
I wasn't actually looking at your nod. I was still trying to translate the French the French song.
Harder than it looks.
So I've actually watched the first couple of days, and they have been amazingly, amazingly exciting.
Yeah, at the end they have. Yeah.
But I still don't really know what's going on, so I can't identify the favourites for the whole race and whether they're doing well or whether they're doing not. So, Chris.
Okay. Well, I think a lot of people would probably be the same. It's actually so far the main favourites have all kind of finished together, and no one's lost any time yet out of the people that are expected to be up there in 3 weeks' time. And so the favourite is Chris Froome. Obviously, Bradley Wiggins was the first British rider to win the Tour de France last year in the 99th Tour de France. Chris Froome looking to become the second in Wiggins' absence this year.
I saw Chris Froome on the Sky Train today.
Oh, is that the bus that takes them from stage to stage?
No, it's just what they've called a group of Sky Riders together. They've called them the Sky Train.
That's right. So Froome's team, Sky, obviously last year Sky had Mark Cavendish as well, so there's maybe some kind of split priorities in terms of what Sky were trying to achieve, although actually... really it was mainly working for Wiggins. But this year they don't have an out and out sprinter. Pretty much every stage the whole Sky team's objective is to look after Froome, so you'll see Froome with a number of other Sky riders around him, sheltering him from the wind, making sure that if he gets a puncture then they're there next to him to quickly swap bikes so he can go off and rejoin the pack. And so, yeah, you'll see the sky, the dark blue sky kit, the riders all together in the peloton. It's quite easy to pick them out when they've got an aerial shot if you're watching it on telly. Froome's closest rivals, and it's kind of arguable, really. Lots of different kind of predictions of who's going to be up there, but the one person that everyone has got in common is, in talking about a rival to Chris Froome, is Alberto Contador, obviously former winner of the Tour on, well, on three occasions, one of which he was stripped of for doping irregularities.
Yeah. Drug cheat.
He still won it twice. He's also won the Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta a España, as well the Tour of Italy and the Tour of Spain. So he's the kind of the experienced you know, winner who's kind of rated as probably the best stage racer of the last 10
years. How was he allowed
years.
To still race? I mean, clearly he was found guilty of something. Was it not as serious
he
as
ate
say,
some dodgy steak? He ate some dodgy steak in an Argentinian restaurant.
I actually can't.
Is that true?
I can't recall the details, but it was a 1 year suspended ban.
Right.
Kind of 3 or 4 months of which he'd already served by that time. So they stripped him of the results that he had got since the positive test up until when he was actually banned.
Okay. And he's now officially clean, is he?
He's officially clean and came back and won the Tour of Spain at the end of last year, which was the first race he'd ridden for over a year. So he's looking, he's not looking great, Contador, but I think the point is with him that he is totally geared his whole season towards the Tour de France. So whereas Froome has won a couple of the other big stage races throughout the early part of the year, Contador has kind of kept his powder dry over the last couple of months, hasn't really done a great deal, but he's one of those guys that, you know, you won't write him off you know, until he absolutely definitely can't win it. But there's lots of other riders. I mean, there's Joaquin Rodriguez from Spain. He came second in Tour of Italy and third in Tour of Spain last year. And the route that we'll come to talk about a little bit later is has got four or five stages that are well suited to a Rodriguez attack. He's kind of known as the guy with the biggest kind of kick up a really steep section. Maybe Froome would rival that now, but Rodriguez, if there's ever a stage that finishes with a really steep 1 kilometre climb, then Rodriguez would be the favourite for that. That's his kind of forte. But then there's the BMC team with Cadel Evans, who won it 2 years ago. And
is he still going? He's about 50 now, right?
He's 36. He's one of the oldest people in the race, and he, like I say, he won it 2 years ago, and then about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, he came third in the Giro d'Italia. So he's, you know, he's got form, and he looks like he's trying to stay out of trouble, trying to stay close to the front. And he wouldn't be doing that if he didn't have designs on having a good overall performance. But he's also on his team got TJ Van Garderen, a young American who won the Young Riders jersey last year.
The white jersey.
That's right, the white jersey.
I remember
jersey.
That name from last year's Tour de France.
Yeah, so TJ is the kind of up-and-coming man. He won the Tour of California back in May, which was a pretty tough route, and he won that fairly comfortably. So he's certainly... there's a bit of dispute, as there would have been if Wiggins was here, over whether Evans and Van Garderen, you know, who's going to be working for who, who's going to be the leader of that team. But Evans is the man they're saying is their leader. But if, like last year, Evans falters or gets ill or whatever, then Van Garderen will be there to kind of take up the lead.
So it's kind of a Evans is the leader until he isn't, kind of.
Exactly, yeah.
Where are BMC from? What's the nationality?
BMC are actually a Swiss team, but okay. They're kind of part owned by Americans as well. So there's a number of American riders and a number of Swiss riders, and then a few other kind of Central European riders as well. So
yeah. How much kudos is associated with teams winning anything? I mean, it's like Formula One, there's a team, but does anyone really care about teams? The team prize, is that a big thing in Tour de France?
The team prize is a big thing for the team that wins it, but it's not going to make any headlines. Basically, they calculate who wins the team prize by they take the times of the top three riders in each team, and whatever the best time is, that team wins. So even the team prize, you only need three of your nine riders to do well to win the team prize.
Yeah.
But certainly in terms of the way the race runs, when you're watching it on TV, if you think of it in terms of what each team is trying to achieve, then it does make a lot more sense. It is very much a team sport, and no one would would win a race, a one-day race, let alone a three-week tour without the support of their team, and not just the other eight guys on the road, but also the directeur sportif, as they say, the team manager in their ear on the intercom the whole time, telling them, giving them all the details of the race and telling what he wants them to do. So.
Okay. So yeah. They're all wired up all the time, and they hear what's happening.
Yeah, in the Tour de France,
in the whole stage. Okay,
that's right. There's two other teams that will, I think, cause problems. One is the Movistar team from Spain, and the other is the Garmin team from the States. So Movistar have two guys who have been talked about as potential top three in this tour: Alejandro Valverde. Who's a former Grand Tour winner, came second in the Tour of Spain last year, and a young Colombian called Nairo Quintana, who could be a good outside bet for the Young Riders jersey. Not even an outside bet, actually. He's probably one of the favourites for the white jersey this year, alongside Van Garderen. And they also have Rui Costa, the Portuguese rider who won the Tour of Switzerland for the second year running a few weeks ago. So he's obviously in good form. So Movistar, they're one of those teams that have got three really good riders, and they could really kind of cause some problems in the mountainous stages with the three of them kind of all attacking, and Sky not knowing who to, Sky may be expending quite a lot of energy trying to keep tabs on, for example, a Quintana attack, only for Valverde to then attack a little later on. Movistar, and then Garmin, similar, they've got Ryder Heyerdahl, who won the Giro d'Italia last year. Andrew Talansky, a young American rider who came second in the Paris-Nice race this year. And then the Irish rider Dan Martin, who is in very good form this season and won the Tour of Catalunya and also won the Liège-Bastogne-Liège race, which is one of the big one-day races in the Ardennes in April. And that's the biggest win of Dan Martin's career. He'll be looking for a top 10 finish overall, but he's one of a number of the top climbers who might also have one eye on the King of the Mountains competition, the polka dot jersey.
So who's favourite for the polka dot jersey this year then?
Well, it's difficult with the polka dot jersey because
Sagan, is it?
The polka dot is the climbing, so it's difficult to kind of identify a clear favourite until they've had a couple of the mountain stages. Certainly the way the route is and the way the scoring system works, it looks likely that it's going to be one of the top guys rather than, as is sometimes the case, a breakaway specialist who will pick up points on along the way in the middle of the stages on the climbs. The big points are for winning stages on the climbs that have a summit finish to the stage. So it's one of those, even someone like Froome or Contador or Rodriguez could kind of may potentially win the overall and win the polka dot jersey.
Is that just because they want to be kind of near the front at most stages, yeah, almost, in all of the races?
Almost win it by default, yeah. Really. I would expect one of the kind of next tier of riders maybe, for example, if someone crashes and loses 10 minutes and realises that they can't win overall anymore, they might try and go for the polka dot jersey instead. And then there's normally with the polka dot jersey, it's the kind of thing that a French rider is going to go for. Thomas Voeckler won it last year.
Thomas Voeckler is my favourite ever cyclist.
He's amazing, that guy. He's one of the, he's like the Paul Collingwood of cycling. He seems to achieve more than he should, like, strictly speaking, be physically capable of doing.
He is the bookie's favourite as well for the polka dot jersey this time.
His teammate Pierre Roland would be another one in the running for that, and also the Frenchman Thibaut Pinot, who also would actually be up there for the Young Riders jersey. He rides for the Française des Jeux team. He won a stage last year and then has since kind of come on leaps and bounds and is looking like a very good climber, Thibaut Pinot. So that's the main kind of contenders for the GC general classification and for the King of the Mountains.
So for the GC tournament you get the yellow jersey.
That's right.
For the mountains, you get the polka dot jersey.
Spotty jumper.
How many more jerseys are there?
There's the green, isn't there?
Well, we've talked about the white jersey for the best young rider. The other one is the green jersey, as Brian says, for the that's the points competition. So that's for the most consistent finisher across all the stages. Which in the Tour de France, when there's seven or eight flat stages, is normally going to be won by a sprinter. And that's the jersey that Mark Cavendish won 2 years ago. That Peter Sagan won last year, and they're the two main contenders for the points jersey this year as well.
So the first day yesterday was a sprint finish.
Yeah.
But none of the sprinters finished.
Yeah, it was crazy yesterday.
Oh, that was the bus being wedged under the gantry.
Unbelievable. Yeah, you talked about earlier how Dustin Brown doesn't have a coach. Well, the Orica Green Edge team from Australia nearly didn't have a coach yesterday as well. It was wedged under the finishing line, kind of hoarding that displayed the scoreboard and the digital clock. And literally 5-6 kilometres to go to the finish, and the bus was still there. They wouldn't be able to finish the race there unless they get the bus moved, and it was just absolute chaos. The riders have got their manager in their ear telling them that, you know, there's a bus at the finish line. don't sprint and crash into it. And then they got told that they would take the positions at 3 kilometres from the finish, and then. Like I said, about 4 kilometres to go, they managed to move the bus and then got back to the riders to tell them, actually, no, you can go to the finish line after all.
It's rather an extreme reaction to being told you can't finish a race.
Yeah,
stopping immediately.
But then it's kind of Chelsea in the Euro final, isn't it, from a couple of years ago? Parking the bus.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, yeah. Parking the bus so no one can get through.
Maybe the bus driver realised it was a bit hot over the next couple of days and tried to turn it into an open top bus.
We'll take off the roof. Yeah, Phil asked me this morning when I did the sports bulletin about the Green Edge Omni team.
Orica Green Edge.
Yeah, that's it. And he said, oh, they're British, aren't they? I was like, I have no idea.
No, they're Australian. Okay. They're an Australian team. A lot of good riders, actually, although no one for the mountains, no one for the general classification, but a lot of good riders. But yeah, so yesterday, in all the chaos with the, you know, where we're going to finish, 3K from the finish, back to the finishing line, the bus has moved, there was a big crash, which I think would be attributed in part to kind of tension in the peloton and no one really knowing what was going on. And all the top sprinters, apart from the German Marcel Kittel, went down. André Greipel, the German champion, Mark Cavendish, of course, and Peter Sagan. They all went down, Nasser Buhani, the Frenchman, as well. And it left Kittel and Alexander Kristoff, the Norwegian, were the two top sprinters in the group that was left to fight it out for the victory. And Kittel out-sprinted Kristoff to win the stage and take the yellow jersey.
Does he stand a chance over Ulf Kittel? Is he a good?
No, he's already lost 12 minutes today, so he's a sprinter.
I mean, of the green jersey.
Of the green jersey, I don't think he's going for the green jersey. Okay. I think he's solely there to try and win a couple of stages. For example, you also get points towards the green jersey in the intermediate sprints along the way, kind of halfway through each stage. And Kittel didn't even go for the sprint today. So I think that's probably a sign that he's not really interested in the green jersey.
The GC is essentially you add up your time for finishing every stage.
That's it. Whoever gets to the end stage quickest wins.
Quite simple. Okay. And the points thing is just stuff you pick up en route if you're interested in that.
Yeah, you win, you get whatever it is, 50 points for winning a stage, 40 points coming second, etc. And then you add the points up for, I think you score if you finish in the top 15 or 20.
I think that's what confuses people, and that you watch a football game and the team that scores the most goals wins, right? You're watching a stage in the Tour de France and it's not obvious what is happening on that particular stage. You know, it might be a time trial, it might be a mountainous stage, and then there's a group of people and somebody breaks away and it's like, who's this guy? And then he gets some points. It's like, well, does that mean he's winning? Right. So any given stage, it's not obvious what's happening in the bigger picture, I think.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to follow it is just solely to concentrate on who's going to win overall.
Okay.
Who's going to win overall, who's got the quickest time, and then second to that, who's going to win this stage today. And you know, they're the most important things. Yep. At the end of the race, the TV will tell you who's winning the points jersey overall, and you can kind of go from there.
Okay.
So today's stage was the second stage. It's won by Belgian rider Jan Bakelants. The most notable incident was about 4 kilometres to go after the bus incident yesterday. Today, a dog.
A chien. Sacre bleu, Rodney. Mange tout, a chien.
A chien drove.
that would be impressive.
Scampered into the middle of the road.
Well,
the lead group narrowly avoided it, and then it was just stood there in the middle of the road, and you're watching on the telly thinking, any second now, the peloton are going to come surging around there at 50 kilometres an hour, and the dog just ran out of the way in time. Its owner didn't know what to do, whether to run in to get it or whether to just shoo it away, and they both kind of just managed to avoid the cyclists as they came through, but that could have been an absolute nightmare.
It was a bit of a scary moment.
Yeah, it sounds terrifying. It's like some sort of film with countdown race against time.
Especially as all of the cyclists are kind of within millimetres of each other's wheels. Yeah. So if one of them had gone down, they would all gone down.
That's right. Yeah. Well, now Bakalints won, held on by 1 second as the peloton surged in on him at the end. Sagan won the sprint for second. But Bakalints, that 1 second was enough to put him into the overall lead. David Miller of Britain is actually second, based on the fact that he's finished fourth and tenth or something in the two stages so far, so he's kind of level on time with a lot of other riders, but his finishing positions have put him into second overall. That will all change tomorrow. It looks like a fairly hilly stage.
Still in
tomorrow.
Corsica tomorrow,
last day in Corsica tomorrow, and then on Tuesday they are across in Nice for a team time trial, and that's where we'll see some of the stronger teams like Sky hopefully helping Chris Froome to put a bit of time into some of their rivals on the weaker teams, like for example Contador Rodriguez. And we'll just to let you know, the first week, and we'll talk again next week about the second week of the tour, but yeah, after the team time trial on Tuesday, it looks like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday should be good chances for sprint finishes. Thursday is pretty much definite sprint finish in Montpellier, where Mark Cavendish won last year. Wednesday and Friday, Wednesday's into Marseille, Friday's into Albi, where I've been several times actually. Very nice place, Albi, and a big cathedral.
Just showing off.
Right? Yeah, there you go. They're also fairly likely to be sprint finishes. There's nothing too severe hill-wise to test the big guys. And then this Saturday is the first big mountain stage. They go into Axtrois Domaine, which is a big summit finish, and last year it was the same, really. The first, it was about stage 8 or 7 or 8 was the first mountain finish, and that's where Wiggins took the yellow jersey, and then he kept it all the way through to Paris. So Froome will be looking for a good team time trial on Tuesday, stay safe Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then try and attack on Saturday and see if he can take the yellow jersey, and that will be his plan. Who knows whether it'll pay off.
Sounds easy.
And then we'll look at it again a week today.
Nice summary.
Yeah, thank you. And it is nice and summery out there at the moment, isn't it? Yeah. So, yeah, Tour de France is well underway, and it's the 100th Tour de France.
La
Centième Tour de France. So, very excited. And obviously, next year, this time, exactly next year,
being
the
Cambridge.
Race will be in Cambridge. The third stage next year will be starting in Cambridge.
Going past your house.
That's right, hopefully. I don't think they've finalised the route to quite that extent yet, but we shall see.
You put in a request, didn't you?
That's right.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
So you got another clue for us, Brian, and the old archive feature.
Yeah, final clue. If I tell you what was number one in the charts for this event, you will almost certainly guess what it was.
Okay.
Tell us.
I've got it. Okay.
I don't.
Okay, well, actually, I had a quick look, and it turns out that at the start of the event,
Fugees.
The number one was Killing Me Softly by the Fugees. But
there was a bit of rotation going on.
There was, yeah. It's the song that I was referring to actually was number one. Sort of, it was the sandwich. It was a Fugee sandwich. Well, they switched over twice actually, but it was Jules Rimet Still Gleaming.
Well, it's the cost of that train ticket Brian was talking about earlier is €96. So maybe that will help you to identify it. But we'll come back to that shortly.
Is it a World Cup?
So before we go to Brian's archive feature, first of all, it's time for our sporting heroes of the week. Sporting hero of the week, Brian.
Okay, well, in second place, I always do two. Sergei Stakhovsky obviously did that amazing performance against Federer, but just seems like a really top dude. Also, has a very beautiful wife, and just seems like a really good. In the French, he took a picture of the line. Do you remember that, with his mobile phone to show the young line? So he's cool. But it's got to be Kimiko Darte Crum, still going strong, 42. Okay, she didn't manage to beat Serena Williams, but then, you know, she's not alone in that. So yeah, doing it for us oldies, Kimiko Darte Crum.
Michael,
I'm going to go Mark Webber. He announced this week that he's leaving Red Bull and leaving Formula One entirely next year. And in a slightly crazy British Grand Prix today, he kind of drove faultlessly to come in second.
And nearly won it. He would have won it with another few laps to go, wouldn't he?
Yep.
I will go predictably for Laura Robson.
In this sort of feature only.
For Sporting Hero of the Week. Oh, well, Sporting Heroine of the Week. Actually, we've got a heroine jingle. Here we are. Yeah, so Laura Rawson, Sporting Heroine of the Week.
Well,
for me, I was tempted to go for the Orica Greenedge bus driver. came a close second.
You've just got to look at the pictures online of his head in his hands.
Oh, the bus driver.
Yeah, to realise he's
well,
a hero.
Well, so it's time for our archive feature now.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
Before we go there, just to let you know, Confederations Cup third place playoff, currently 2-2 Uruguay against Italy. Looks like a bit of a cracker there. Cavani scored twice for Uruguay, the Manchester City new
Edinson,
City signing.
Edinson Cavani.
Cavani has scored twice. Diamanti scored for Italy to put them 2-1 ahead, but Cavani's equalised in 78th minute, and Suarez is playing as well for Uruguay. We'll let you know the final score if it comes in before the end of the show. Now, Brian, the first clue again. Let's explain the clues.
Okay, so the first clue was the cost of a standard rail ticket from Madrid to Lisbon on board the overnight Lusitania train.
So I'm guessing 96 euros.
96,
right?
Yeah, euros, 96, as it says on the website. The first time, yeah, the Euros 96 went from 8 to 16 teams.
Yeah, and that's right.
The final clue, what was number one in the charts? Well, I just gave it away there. It was, of course, Three Lions by Bedil and Skinner, with some help from Ian Broody of the Lightning Seeds. What I don't get about that, by the way, is Jules Rimet still gleaming, but that's a different tournament entirely.
Yeah.
But I suppose it was obviously 30 years since 1966.
Well, I think it's a thankless task to try and pick apart the obtuse poetry of the Lightning Seeds. So let's not try. We'll just get ourselves in a pickle.
Yeah, I was trying to remember if this was...
Oh, that was an unintentionally excellent joke.
Nice, very good. I was trying to remember if this was the tournament where they first did fantasy football on the couch. It probably was, but I couldn't find that. But anyway, there you go. So, yes, Euro 96, which
no, it wasn't the first time they did fantasy football. They'd already been doing it for a few years.
Okay.
That's why they were popular enough to get the gig to do the song.
That makes more sense, okay. Yeah. Anyway, Euro 96, I remember this very well because I was in Nottingham at the time, and Nottingham was one of the host cities for the Euro 96. But yeah, it was great to be in England. First time we'd hosted a major football tournament for 30 years, and obviously the last time we did it
we won,
so it was a lot of expectation, but the build-up was troubled. I don't know if you remember this, the lead-up, there was a alcohol-related dentist chair stunt,
the dentist chair
in a Hong Kong bar.
I do.
And this was during England's preparations. This was LTEL. Terry Venables was in charge, so Gascoigne had been on the front pages and the back pages pretty much of all of the tabloid press back in Britain, and that caused a major falling out with the press. So, and also Cathay Pacific put out a statement, according to Martin Samuels, I think, of The Sun, saying that the England team had caused £5,000 worth of damage on the plane. So anyway, this was the background to this tournament. And I think this is probably what caused the team to have a lot of togetherness, because they were, you know, there's a lot with, obviously LTEL's a good manager, but they were pretty much sort of up against it with the press back home slating them before they'd even started. And the opening ceremony at Wembley, Pelé was there. The opening game was England-Switzerland. Not a great opening match for England. It was a 1-1 draw. Alan Shearer scored a 23rd minute goal, equaled by Kubilay Türkyılmaz. Remember
him? Türkyılmaz, yes.
Türkyılmaz, yeah. That was a penalty. Stuart Pearce handballed it. And interestingly, Gazza came in for a bit of criticism because he was clearly a bit unfit. And by the end of that game, he was huffing and puffing a lot. So, you know, building on the dentist chair and so on. Next game was Scotland. Great Shearer header from a Gary Neville cross. Good save.
Oh, and then it just went. The second half of that game was brilliant.
It was brilliant, yeah. Seaman played very well in that game. David Seaman, just watched a few clips, and he made some brilliant saves. Tony Adams, though, brought down Gordon Jury for a Gary McAllister penalty, which was stopped by the big man himself.
Which Seaman claims to have moved the ball with his mind.
Was that a goal?
I don't think so. I think he saw the ball wobble on the penalty
spot. It was a great stop, though. But in the 78th minute is the goal I think we all remember.
It was literally right up the other end from the penalty miss.
Straight
after the penalty miss. So it went from being one, looking like it might go 1-1 to being 2-0.
Yeah.
But what a goal that was, eh? Gazza.
Gazza, yeah. Flipped it over a defender. You probably know who that was.
Colin Hendry.
Hendry. Was he at Forest at that point?
No, he's never
Blackburn,
played
probably. Blackburn, sorry. Yes. And then, of course, the celebration.
The dentist chair
celebration. Gazza on his back with the water bottle.
Teddy Sheringham squirting the water bottle into his face.
One of the enduring images of of British football, English football rather. England's next game was probably one of their best ever performances, I think, internationally. 4-1 victory against Gus Hiddink's Holland. And great starting lineup. He kept, Eltel kept the same 11. Seaman, Neville, Pierce, Adams, Ince, Southgate, Gascoigne, McManaman, Shearer, Sheringham and Darren Anderton. That's a pretty good England team, I think.
Apart from Anderton.
Well, yeah. Anderton. He wasn't that,
that was the stage when Anderton would basically be injured for 23 months and then be fit again just before the before the major tournament.
Yeah. They call him Sick Note.
Clever man.
I think that nickname's been used for a few players. Yeah, so this is the brilliant performance against Holland. Paul Ince was brought down in the box and Shearer scored his third goal of the tournament from the penalty spot. There was a great attempt from Bergkamp, Dennis Bergkamp, playing for the Holland national side. Pretty dodgy back pass from Southgate. Bergkamp ran onto it, but another brilliant David Seaman save. And then Teddy Kerrigan popped up with a great header. 2-0. Into the 5 minutes in the second
from
half
from a Gary Neville cross, as I recall.
Oh yeah, he was good in that tournament, Gary Neville. And the third goal, this was the probably the best goal that England have maybe ever scored. Brilliant little run from Gascoigne, stayed strong in the box, little flick to Sheringham, passed it on to Shearer. Shearer drilled it home. That was his fourth goal in
laced
three games.
Laced it
in the corner. Can you picture that goal in your mind? It's very just the way they combined those three. And Sheringham then followed up from a deflected shot to make it 4-0. And there was a consolation goal from Patrick Kluivert, and it was 4-1. And actually, this result was so unpredicted, so surprising, that Ladbrokes hadn't even put it on the coupon, apparently. Wow. He couldn't back England to win 4-1 in that game. Quarterfinals against Spain.
I was just going to say, incidentally, that Patrick Kluivert goal not Scotland out. Like if England had won 4-0, then Scotland would have gone through. So
it's like a double win.
It was hilarious.
Brilliant. There you go. Quarterfinals against Spain. This is still, in I think, the only time. Correct me if I'm wrong here. The only penalty shootout England have won at a major tournament.
That is true.
So yeah, unusually for England, they emerged victorious via the shootout. Alan Shearer, David Platt, Paul Gascoigne, and most memorably of all, Stuart Pearce.
Psycho.
And of course, Stuart Pearce had been one of the players whose penalty kick had been saved in the 1990 World Cup semi-final in Italia 90. And it's been voted the best goal celebration ever by readers of the Daily Mirror. everyone remembers Psycho. He really...
The emotion kind of poured out, didn't it? I don't think he was even expecting it.
Do you want to know a little-known fact? Miguel Nadal, who was Rafa Nadal's uncle, missed his spot kick. And then Gazza scored to put England through to the semi-finals. The semi-finals, who remembers the semi-finals? In the other semi-final, by the way, France and the Czech Republic drew 0-0, and that went to penalties. Reynald Pedros was the only player to miss, so the Czechs through to the final. And, of course, it was a repeat of the 1990 World Cup semi-final between Germany and England. Shearer headed in. That was his fifth goal of the tournament. He got the golden boot for 96. And then Stefan Kuntz levelled 15 minutes later. And I hope you've been all just tuned in at that exact moment. And of course, the score remained 1-1 after 90 minutes. And then Gascoigne very nearly got a golden goal. Remember that?
It was inches away,
fractionally missed. Only if he did a bit fitter, he'd have got it.
Anderton hit the post.
That was my next line.
No,
Darren
I got there first.
Post.
Too late, Brian.
Kuntz had a goal disallowed for pushing. And of course, the penalties. Both sides scored their first five kicks. So actually, good penalty performance there for England again. But Gareth Southgate, of course, famously had his penalty save. And who popped up to score the winner for Germany?
I'm not sure. Muller?
Yes, Andreas Muller scored the winning goal.
Yes.
So there you go, heartbreak for England again. But that's probably that's the furthest we've been in any tournament since. And of course, the final was the Czech Republic hoping to repeat their win in Euro 1976. And the Germans were aiming to win their third European Championship. But interestingly, their only ever win as the United Germany was in Euro 96. And Patrick Berger scored a penalty in the 59th minute, and then Oliver Bierhoff levelled it in 1-1. And then it was the golden goal. It was the first tournament to be decided by a goal. And, and who scored the...
Bierhoff again.
Bierhoff,
With a wicked deflection,
mishandled by Kuba. And there you go. Actually, the first major tournament to be decided by a golden goal was the 1995 Otto Windscreels fight. Windscreels Shield final.
Otto Windscreels sounds better.
Windscreels, yeah. So there you go. That was in Euro 96. Well done, Germans.
Brilliant.
Germans. And they adopted three lines as their song. They were singing it in the Champions League final this year. It all came from Euro 96.
Thanks for that, Brian. You've been listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105. We'll be back next week with our Ashes preview. It's only 10 days to the Ashes starts. And also we'll have our roundup of Wimbledon and the latest from the Tour de France. What other sport is happening this week? Well, there's obviously the decisive Lions test in Australia on Saturday morning. That's one all with one test to go. And actually the varsity cricket match between Cambridge and Oxford Universities takes place from Tuesday to Friday next week at Fenners. So it's a four-day game and it'll be on from probably 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning throughout the day, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Thanks a lot, Brian and Mike.
Thank you.
No problem. Mike, you're going to do an archive feature for us next week, maybe?
Yeah, why not?
If I can get still your talk. Thinking cap on. And coming up next here on Cambridge 105 is Rock Lit with Alan Alder, and then Headstand with Patrick, and Mill Road with Kerry Littlechild, and then Ezio at 10 with Songsmith Sessions. Thanks a lot for listening. We've been Summer Sports Week. See you next week.
We're right up your street. This is Cambridge 105.